another edition of In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. And the show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Services, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic. And as always, powered by the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. And that means writer extraordinaire, golfer extraordinaire, and super producer, Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, we have a very special Inside the Coach's Corner this evening. Our guest is, he's a man for all seasons. We could call him a Renaissance man. He attended City College of Baltimore, where he was an all-city player, won a championship, grew up in the Cherry Hill neighborhood of Baltimore City, attended Philadelphia University, formerly Textile and Science. He joined the police force in the mid-70s, and he would later become the first African-American, and I repeat, the first African-American to command the Central District at the Baltimore Police Department. Now, he holds a number of certifications and has been published in multiple journals and magazines, and is the author of that best-selling book, Ham Rules, Relationships, Love, and Leadership. Currently, he's serving as the Director of Public Safety and a professor at Coppin State University. He is my friend, my brother. He is Commissioner Leonard Ham. Commissioner Ham, I am so honored to have you here in the Coach's Corner. How are you?
Coach, I'm doing well, and I'm flattered, man. I listened to your show, and I listened to Sam Jones, Oscar Robinson, and last night, Ernie Graham. I'm flattered. I'm flattered to be speaking with you now.
Well, this is going to be another classic, and I'm going to start it off with a unique question. And God has blessed you with a lot of different skill sets and accomplishments. But here the question goes, are you a better police officer, ball player, or dresser? Because you're excellent at all three. And we'll get to the dressing part, folks, a little later. But the first question, right off the top, better police officer, better ball player, or clothes horse?
All I'm related to each other. I got into the dressing thing, you know, back in South Baltimore in Cherry Hill. I got into playing basketball because, you know, and playing basketball for me was different than a lot of people. I taught myself how to play basketball because I needed something to do to feel good about me. You know, growing up in Cherry Hill, I had this self-esteem thing going on, you know, and I had to do something that I felt good about me. So I taught myself how to play basketball, and I got better and better and better and better. And what I found out was the principles that I used to learn how to play basketball were the same principles that could be used to be a good police officer.
Wow.
So I just traded one discipline to the other discipline, and it seemed to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about growing up in Baltimore's Cherry Hill neighborhood. What was it like then compared to what it's like now?
Well, Cherry Hill, when I first went to Cherry Hill, it was 1954, and I happened to be 4 years old. When I went to Cherry Hill, it was like a paradise for me. Grass, green, cherry trees, apple trees, no stoplights. We had a stoplight at one end of Cherry Hill and a stoplight at the other end of Cherry Hill. And basically all we did was rip, run, and ran. If you were an athlete, if you were a young person, it was a paradise for you. Now, let's talk about the educational system when I grew up in Cherry Hill. The education I received in Cherry Hill was absolutely outstanding. The teachers were outstanding. In the third grade, I was diagramming sentences. In the fifth grade, I was doing research papers. In the seventh grade, I was doing trigonometry and had no idea that I was doing all this stuff until
wow.
I went to high school and college and found out I know this junk.
Mm-hmm.
It was outstanding. Now, Cherry Hill changed, as far as I'm concerned, in 1968. I went away to college, Philadelphia Textile, in 1967, came back in 1968. Drugs had been introduced into the community, and a lot of my guys that I knew, were hooked on drugs. And I don't think, in my opinion, Cherry Hill has recovered since.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. And you've often mentioned your foundation. And your foundation was your family, i.e., your father and your mother. And you talked about your father being a brilliant man.
My father was
skilled and just he could sew. He was great in mathematics, as you just stated. So tell our listeners a little bit about your father.
Well, first of all, what I found out was, and the guys that I hung with at Cherry Hill, my father was the only father that stayed. See, I had a mother and father. We grew up in the projects, but my mother and father stayed. We were a family. And guys came over our house, and my father used to talk to them. My father loved those guys, you know, and he would talk to them, and they would galvanize around him and all that stuff. My father was an absolute, he could do anything. He could sew. He could draw. My father did mathematical problems to relax himself. Now, he also was a gambler and a card player, too, and he was very good. And I asked him one time, I said, man, why you? He used to sit at the card table, you know, flip cards. I said, man, why you do that? He said, it relaxes me. It relaxes me. What happened with my father was he was just a Renaissance man before his time. He had seven kids, and he told me one time, man, every time I wanted to do something, I had another kid. And he kind of saw himself as a failure. And I had to tell him one day, as a grown man now, you know, I'm in the police department and I'm the commanding officer, and I had to tell him, I said, your strengths were your children.
That's right.
I said, that was your genius. That's where it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Here's just seven of us, great in school, great in doing all the stuff that we're supposed to do. I said, that's your genius. I said, that's your genius. And I tried to explain to him that, you know, when you go generations down, all of it's going to come back and reflect to you.
Absolutely.
And he just looked at me and didn't say anything. But
yeah,
that was the truth.
And also, having said that, you once said that you asked your mother, who you would witness get up at 5, go to work, and come back. And you want to ask your mom, well, Mom, what do you do for recreational? What do you do for your enjoyment? And her response was?
Watching you all grow up.
That's powerful,
that's what
man.
She said. Now,
powerful.
Let me share something else with you.
Okay.
I can remember being in the fifth grade. And, you know, I was supposed to do some chores when I got out of school, clean the kitchen and all this stuff. So my mother gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning and she goes to work. She would normally get home at about 4 o'clock. I was supposed to clean the kitchen up, and I didn't. And we got our report cards that day. Coach, I failed. My report card was completely red.
Good gracious.
I failed everything. And the kitchen wasn't clean. And she came in, and she saw that, and she saw my report card. My mother sat in the kitchen floor, and she cried.
Mm.
I didn't say one word. I started cleaning up the kitchen. I made a vow I will never, ever be the source of her pain again. Never.
Mm.
that set me on this path to do right. Man, watch your mother sitting in the kitchen floor crying because you didn't do what you were supposed to do. And she's working and she's slaving and she's doing all this stuff. And to come home and see that and then be given this report card, I said, never again. From
wow.
that day on, from that day on, I vowed, I am going to be something. I'm going to be somebody that she can be proud of.
Wow, that's powerful. And in the Coach's Corner this evening, former Commissioner Baltimore City, currently the Director of Safety and Professor at Coppin State University, he is Leonard Hamm. Commissioner Hamm, let's go back to the Cherry Hill neighborhood. And I know each and every neighborhood is special. You are a regular listener and supporter of the show. You've heard Bob Wade, Muggsy Bogues, Timmy Green, Skip Wise, Reggie Williams, to name a few from East Baltimore. And they took special pride last night. Ernie Graham talked about growing up on the east side of Baltimore. But talk about Cherry Hill and some of the other renowned citizens or residents from Cherry Hill, because I believe that the renowned attorney, Billy Murphy, is from Cherry Hill, correct?
Billy and I grew up together in Cherry Hill. Billy played golf. He on his lawn, he hit golf balls, you know, in the back of our house. Now, we lived in the projects. Billy lived in the private house, but he would hit these golf balls, and they would break our windows in the projects. Now, Billy he went to Poly. He was a third string quarterback at Poly. So when we used to have these football games, these pickup football games, and all this kind of stuff, Billy used to want a quarterback. All right. And what Billy would want to do is call plays and have huddles and do all this old kind of stuff that he learned in school. Say, man, get out of here with this stuff. Get out of here with this stuff. But we allowed that to happen because he was Billy Murphy.
Yeah.
But Billy and I grew up together, you know, and Robert Wallace grew up in Cherry Hill. There were so many, many renowned people that grew up and athletes.
Senator Nat Oaks.
That's right. Matt Oaks was out there in Cherry Hill. Anthony Carter, Mike Moulton, just on and on and on and on and on. Just great people because it breeded all of that. Because in Cherry Hill, it was all about church, family, school, and the rest of it. You know, we just played ball, and, you know, we just kind of enjoyed each other. And Cherry Hill was really a safe place to be. It was the best-kept secret in the city. We didn't really have any problems until, like I said, 1968. That's when drugs was introduced into the community, and we haven't quite recovered the way we should. Now, also in Cherry Hill, we had everything that we needed in Cherry Hill. Well, there was no reason to leave Cherry Hill. The only thing we didn't have was a high school. We had two swimming pools, six recreation centers. We had a movie. We had a pool room. We had a shopping center. There was no need for us to leave Cherry Hill. When I went to city and guys would come to city to visit us, they said, man, this is great. You all don't even have to come in town. And we didn't.
Wow.
Plus, Coach, I have to tell you this.
Okay.
Cherry Hill had the prettiest goddamn girls, boy, in the city. And them guys used to come out of Cherry Hill for them girls. I'm telling you. The girls in Cherry Hill were absolutely gorgeous.
Wow,
girls,
yeah,
man.
I've heard that now. I've certainly
gorgeous
heard
girls.
I've heard that. Let's talk about the basketball. And as you mentioned earlier, you played the various sports, but you played basketball for self-esteem. And you develop some pretty good skills. You go to City College, and let's talk about that and talk about your coach. Everyone in Baltimore talks about the renowned coach, the famous coach at City College. And then, what was it, 66 or 67, you guys win the city championship against Dunbar.
and that was in 65, 66. But I'll tell you that, I started playing basketball, you know, in the eighth and ninth grade. And when I was in the eighth and ninth grade, the grown men used to choose me because my game had developed to that level. So I'm kind of hanging around one day, and I see this guy on the basketball court, which I had already adopted as my court. You don't come on there and not let you come through me.
All right.
So here's a guy on my court that I've never seen before, and he's in basketball gear, and he's spin dribbling, and he's pulling off a jump shot, and he's got on, you know, Chuck Taylor shoes, and so who's this guy? So I went up there, and I'm looking at him, and he was a ball player at City. Now, this was at the summertime. He's a ball player at City, and he was on a JV team going to the varsity team. I said, I got to play him. Now, I'm in dress shoes and dress clothes. I said, man, so he and I did it one-on-one. I went at him, you know. So I'm all sweaty. He's all sweaty. So he says to me, what high school do you go to? I said, man, I'm in junior high school. I'm not even in high school. He said, oh, my gracious. He said, you got to come to City. I said, okay. I go to City, trial for the basketball team. 900 boys show up for the basketball team. I said, man, I'm not going to put up this. So I said, I'm leaving here. So I decided to stay. And they put me on the side and put a whole bunch of other people on the side. So, you know, I really went to City because of its academics and also because of its basketball. But, Coach, I had to catch three buses from Cherry Hill to get to Northeast Baltimore. Three buses, man. I had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go to that school because that's what I wanted to do. And then I ran into Jerry Phipps. I mean, this guy, you talk about your Morgan Wootens, you talking about your John Woodens, you talk about this guy was in that mold. He was a white coach. We didn't even realize he was white because of the way he came at us and the way he treated us. And the way we acted. And I'm telling you, I said it in my book, my father taught me how to be a man. Jerry Phipps taught me how to be a successful man in a white man's world. Taught me that.
You know, when I first met you, and we'll talk about the first encounter between you and I, but everyone was telling me how great of a player you were, basketball. And I believe them because there were people like Clayton Tucker and Cleve Brister. And, you know, those, for me, if they sanction you or certify you, it's gospel. But what really sealed the deal, you know, we have a saying over here in D.C. and probably in Baltimore, same thing, that game knows game.
Right.
When I had a chance to interview Dickie Kelly, and he raved about you, it was signed, sealed, and delivered, as Stevie Wonder would say. I knew you were the real deal.
Coach.
Talk about your encounters,
Coach,
with the great Dickie Kelly.
Dickie, and I would tell you this, talk about all those guys who went to the pros. Dickie was the best the city ever produced. The best.
Better than Skip.
Dickie came.
Better than Skip.
What? Did Skip play any defense? Did Skip play any defense? Dickie played D. Dickie Kelly came in an era that is just one now time. And that's happened to guys in D.C., and that happened to him.
That's
Dickie
right.
Kelly, you know, we're down this Civic Center thing. You know, playing Dunbar for the championship, and we are literally blowing Dunbar off the floor. We're running him out the gym, and I can't believe it. You know, it's the third quarter, Coach, and we up by 25, blowing him out the quarter. That's when Dickie said to himself, "To hell with this." And I say, "Okay." And it was me and Dickie from the third quarter. to the rest of the town. And I'm going to tell you, we had zoned out the Civic Center. That may have been 3,000, 7,000. I didn't care. It was me and him. Now, you don't get that. I knew as a defensive player, I'm not going to stop Dickie. What I wanted to do was make him make a superior offensive move every time down the floor. Coach, you understand what I'm talking about?
Absolutely.
When a score does that, when it does that, it takes his energy away.
That's right.
Dickie made a superior offensive move every time down the floor. He wore me out. Now, here's the deal. This was a thing. This was a clincher. Dickie is right-handed. He's drilling to the left corner with his left hand. The deep corner, he goes up for a jump shot, and it's right-handed. Dickie's right-handed. And I'm on it. I'm leaping with him, and I say, I got it. I'm going to grab this ball off his right hand. In midair, Dickie swishes it to his left hand, threw his right hand down. And so I'm down on his right hand, but the ball's in his left hand now. He flicks his wrist. It's nothing but the bottom of the hoop.
Wow.
I told the coach, get me out of here. I'm through. Get me out of here. Take me. I'm tired. Get me out of here. Dickie brought them all the way back. I'm telling you, I said, we ended up winning the game. But Dickie Kelly, you're talking about heart. You're talking about defense. You're talking about toughness. Dickie ain't weighing no more than 130 pounds.
Wow.
No more than 130 pounds. Dickie Kelly was probably one of the best that this city ever produced, but never got the chance at that pro thing to do because of timing and because of the way things were.
That's right. And for the sake of our listeners, let them know your physical dimensions when you were in high school and college.
Well, I was in high school and college. I was about 6'2", 6'3". I weighed maybe 160, 170, maybe 180 pounds, you know,
okay.
And I could leap real good. So I had the skills to play the one guard, the two guard, and I could play a small forward. I could play those three.
Sure.
But what I understood was, you know, if you want to play, you know, you have to do certain things. So I decided, well, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to play defense, you know, and especially when I went to college, you know, I'm going to play defense. And when I was in college, what I enjoyed was I love practice. I really love practice because that's when you got a chance to really show how good you were in practice, believe it or not. And I used to kill the starters, kill them, you know. So, but we had Herb McGee. Herb McGee had his system, and that's the way his system was. And I was never a person to beef about playing time or upset the karma of the team and all that kind of stuff. You know, I wasn't going to do that. What I wanted to do was just win. I just wanted to win.
And that's the object of it. Just win, baby. So let's segue from Baltimore City College to Philadelphia Textile and Science, now currently known as Philadelphia University. Talk about the transition from a cultural standpoint, because now growing up in Cherry Hill, going to City College, not around a lot of white folks.
Oh, man, let me tell you. So I go up at the Philadelphia Textile. There's six black people up there. I'm one of the six. So I go into the dormitory athletes room, and the only other black guy on the team comes in and says, "That's my bed." Now, I've been in that bed for a week. So he comes and says, "That's my bed." So now we got the fight. Oh, man. So I beat him up. You know, he's from Philadelphia. I beat him up. But we became friends. You know, we became friends. We became really friends, you know. And but that whole thing and that whole culture was an uncomfortable thing to me. I went to the president of the university. I said, "I have a problem with this." He said, Leonard, what's the matter? I said, "There ain't no black people here." He said, "Well, how can I help you?" I said, "Well, how about giving me a budget to recruit black people from the public schools of Philadelphia. And he, the president, he said, okay.
Wow.
I said, how about having a room where we can party, you know, like a black student room? He said, okay. And he gave me sound equipment and all this stuff. And I went out into Philadelphia and recruited black people to come to that school so I could feel comfortable. And he allowed that. He allowed that. So we did all of those things. Now, this is what I discovered when it was time for me to graduate from Philadelphia Tech. They hired a coordinator for black affairs because of the stuff that, you know, I was doing and we were doing up there. He told me, he said, they're going to let you graduate, but they ain't going to ever recruit anybody from Baltimore again because of you at this school. I said, okay.
Why?
I said, okay. Okay. But they did. You know, but they did. So,
you know, and
but that
and
was a thing. It, yeah. Culturally, man, it was difficult. It really was hard, you know, because there weren't any black folks there. But let me tell you this, I wasn't going to leave. I wasn't going to go because I always went back to my mother crying on the kitchen floor. And my thing was, I cannot leave this place without a degree. I can't do that.
That and also the conversation you had with your father, and he basically told you how proud he was of you, and that because, as stated earlier in the interview, he had so many gifts, but because back then black men did not have the opportunity, and so he was living and fulfilling his dreams through you, and that gave you
He wrote me a letter.
Yeah.
Coach, he wrote me a letter, and I was homesick. I was crying. I was sad. And all of a sudden, this letter comes, and it's from my father. And you have to understand, my father wasn't that kind of guy. We didn't kind of talk like that, you know. And he put in this letter how proud of me he was, and that he was living his life vicariously through me. And I'm telling you, it opened my eyes. I never knew that this man, first of all, I never knew he had that depth of emotion. I never knew he felt like that about me, you know. And when I read that letter, I said, okay, it's on now. The degree, I'm going to get that. I'm going to get that. I can't not succeed after knowing that this man feels this way about me.
Wow. Yeah, that was awesome, and that was some great motivation. But also, we'd be remiss if we didn't mention you win a city championship, and then you go and win what? Another championship at Textile and Science. Talk about that.
What happened was, first of all, in high school, I never lost a basketball game in high school. As a junior, we beat Dunbar. We were 20-0. We knocked Dunbar off 2 in a row. And I see Dickie Kelly. I love Dickie. We hug one another whenever we see one another. And then Dickie said, Lenny, I ain't never forgot. I said, Dickie, it was 60 years ago. Come on, man. Leave it alone.
No,
said, I ain't going to leave it alone. I ain't going to leave it alone. I ain't going to leave it alone. So, you know, we knocked Dickie off. And then we come back the next year. And I'm thinking we're going to play Dunbar again. But they got knocked off by St. Joe Catholic School. So we're going through, you know, the tunnel to come out on the floor. And they had a Dunbar guys. Then he had, you know, I hate to see you here. You know, I hate to see you. So I said, yeah, I know you do. Sit in the seat, enjoy yourself, enjoy the show. You sit there and relax.
I love the trash talking.
Trash talk. So, you know, we knocked them off. So I come out of high school 40-0. Never lost a game in high school. Two championships. So we go to Philadelphia Textile, you know, and we win the Division II championship too. But the curious thing about that was the process to winning the championships in high school And in college, the process was the same. It was the same. Different players, different coaches, but the process was the same. And what that showed me was, if I'm going to be successful, I have to adopt this process, because this process supersedes any occupation. So I come to the Baltimore Police Department and I apply a basketball process to be successful in the police department.
Wow. And talk about how you got to be a police officer. I mean, I don't know if many young men or ladies from your neighborhood went into the police force, but talk about how
Coach,
you joined
I went to the police department because when I went up to New York and was working things, and things were great. However, I wasn't ready for New York, man. It was too much too soon. You know, I come from the projects, and when you're wearing around, I was wearing fur coats then at the age of 21 and bracelets and staying up all night. And, man, that wasn't me. I came home one Christmas, and my mother told me, you ain't going back no more. You're going to die. You ain't going back no more. So my bankroll was getting low, and I needed a job. And the Baltimore Police Department was hiring us. So I said, you know, I'm a black guy with a college degree. You know, I think, you know, I'm an attractive candidate. So I went and applied for the job, and I was hired, and I went to the academy, Baltimore Police Academy, in 1970, and found out, 71, excuse me, and found out I was naturally good at police work, and I loved it. 47 years later, I'm still doing that stuff. And I applied the same process and the same principles of being successful on the basketball court to the police profession.
What was your philosophy as a police officer and then as a police commissioner? I've often heard you speak of community service, and you've had past commissioners and politicians say, well, the role of police officer is not to be a psychiatrist or psychologist or social worker. But you say the opposite. Talk about your philosophy.
I say the opposite because the only consistent thing in the community is the community, Coach. Police commissioners change. Mayors change. Politicians change. The only constant is the community. So my definition of community policing is this. Police and law-abiding citizens working together to arrest criminals. And see, people think that that community policing is soft on crime. It's not. To arrest criminals, stop crime, increase the quality of life in the community and help the community solve problems. That's what community policing is. So if you come up with a project, a program, a strategy that satisfies those things, that's community policing. And guess what? In every community, it's different. It's different. There's no cookie cutter to talk about community policing. And yes, we are psychologists, because at 4 o'clock in the morning, we're the only ones that's out there. I can't tell you the number of calls for service that I handled as a young police officer in the wintertime in December, when I would get a call because my furnace ain't working no more and I'm cold. So they call the police. So I don't say to these people, well, ain't nothing I can do about that. Hell, you know, put on some blankets and freeze. No, I don't do that. I don't do that. And I didn't teach my officers to do that when I was an instructor in the academy. I call the gas and electric company, the emergency line, and I may have, you know, stressed the truth a little bit and say, we smell gas here. You need to come out. But they came out anyway.
That's right.
But they came out anyway. So that's my whole philosophy. The community is what's a constant. And the community has to tell police what they want police to do and how to police us. They have to do that. Else what's going on there is not going to work. You can't have a police agency or police people who only spend 8 hours or 10 hours in a community telling community what we're going to do for you. This is what you need. You don't know what they need until you talk to them.
What was it like with your philosophy as you just laid out, which I agree with you totally, but what was it like initially working under a mayor that had a total opposite philosophy of law and order, lock them up? And I'm talking about Mayor O'Malley.
I like Martin O'Malley. I really do. I like him personally. Me and Martin O'Malley used to argue all the time behind closed doors. I would never argue with him in the public. And let me tell you why I wouldn't do it. Not because I didn't have any courage or anything like that, but that would have upset the public. Just like I never argued with Pat Jessamy, the state's attorney. People can't see us in positions like that arguing with each other because it upsets them. So with Martin O'Malley, we would get behind closed doors. We would yell and scream and hoop and holler at each other, but we came up with one message. However, if that message was contrary to what I wanted, I still had my troops under me. They did what I say do. They did what I say do.
Wow.
And at the end of it, you know, I would take the heat, but they did what I said do. And I had some of the finest young men and women policing under me when I was police commissioner. Marcus Brown, John Skinner, Boxdale. These guys were under 50 years old and had at least 20 years on, and they were go-getters. They were thoroughbreds. And all they needed was a leader to unleash them, and that's what I did.
Yeah. We're talking with former police commissioner, Baltimore City, and currently the director of public safety and a professor at Coppin State University. My good friend, my brother, he is Leonard Hamm. Now, you've talked about your main mentors and influences as a young man, your parents. Then you talked about your coaches, your high school coach, your college coach.
Yeah,
you talked about Nikki Kelly. But now let's talk about one or two of your mentors and influences as a police officer. I know you always give props to Bishop Robinson. So expound on that.
Bishop Robinson was the foremost law enforcement official in this country. We all wanted to be Bishop. Not only was he smart, not only was he tactical, he was sharp, man. He dressed, he wore that stuff.
He could not outdress you. Now, he may have been an influencer, but he couldn't outdress you.
Well, what I did was expounded on what he laid down. He had the format, but I took it to a different level.
Let me say this for some of our listeners who may not know you, and the commissioner is such a humbled individual. But let me tell y'all, this is one of the best dressers I know. He is always cleaner than a New York pallbearer. That's how clean he is. So go ahead,
I appreciate that. But Bishop Eddie Tillman, Eddie Woods.
Okay.
These three guys, they tutored me, they groomed me to be a police commissioner. They saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And let me tell you what these guys did. Not only did they groom me, but they had the foresight to understand what they're going to do for me was generational. Because they took this boy from Cherry Hill It allowed my son to live extremely well. It allowed his sons, my granddaughters to live extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about these guys, that's what, and they didn't just do it for me. A lot of us are living well because these guys understood generational wealth. They understood it. They understood it. And that's the legacy. So I talk to them all the time. All the time there. Right now, Eddie Woods, the leader, he's the only one that's alive. But whenever we're having something, whenever we're doing something, when we invite Eddie to come, we send a car to pick him up.
Wow,
we send a car to take him home. That's the esteem that we have for him because he created a situation in Bishop and Ed Tillman where all of us can live well, man. All of us can live well. And what we do, those of us who think right, we pass this down to the community. We haven't forsaken the community. Now, we don't make a whole bunch of noise and yelling, screaming, marching, all this stuff, but we take care of some folks and we take care of our own.
No question about it. And so for Martin O'Malley, who was the mayor, who initially brings you in as police commissioner,
he
goes to Annapolis, becomes the governor, and then Sheila Dixon take over. Talk about working in the Dixon administration.
I made a lot of mistakes with Sheila. One of the mistakes I should have gone to her and said, Madam Mayor, what is it that you want me to do? How do you want me to run my department? I did not do that. I did what I wanted to do, and she fired me, and rightfully so. And rightfully so. I wasn't upset about that. I was really glad to leave, to be quite honest with you, because I just didn't feel confident in her administration and where she was going. So the fact she got rid of me, you know, it really was a blessing. So it panned out later on, you know, we don't have to go into all of that kind of stuff.
But now, am I correct by saying, and I'm going to use a sports analogy that you and some of our listeners can relate to, others may not. You remember when Tony Dungy was the coach of Tampa Bay?
That's right.
And he gets fired, and then the next year they get a new coach, okay?
Won the Super Bowl.
They win the Super Bowl. Now,
right.
The new coach gets the credit, he gets the pats on the back, the accolades,
right.
But it was
right.
Tony Dungy's players that really did it. Can the same thing be said about you in terms of what you implemented as the police commissioner? You're fired,
what
as
happened?
You stated, and then Commissioner, what is it, Belfeld?
Fred Belfeld.
Comes in.
Belfeld.
Yeah, he comes
Fred.
In. The Yeah, go ahead.
Fred stuck with the plan. He didn't change it. He stuck with the plan that myself, Marcus, Boxdale, and he, you know, was a part of. We put this plan together. He stuck with it, and he got lows on homicides, shootings, and all of this stuff. So it made everybody look like a genius who was still there. But Fred knows, and the troops know, you know. But here's the thing with that. I want Fred to take that credit. Because had it gone south the other way, maybe he would have had that blame. But Fred stuck with the program, and he got the accolades. So I don't have any problems with that. These were good guys. They worked hard for me. We're still friends. When I see them, you know, we embrace one another, and we have good thoughts about each other. And we worked together and we did some things. And that's what's needed in this department today, which you don't have. Two things.
Okay.
Leadership and relationships are everything in this world. If you don't have those two things, nothing you do is going to succeed. Nothing. We had that when I had those young folks. We had leadership and we had relationships. What I see in this city today is you don't have that. Now, when I'm talking about leadership, I'm talking about leadership all up and down the lines, not necessarily at the top, but your sergeants, your lieutenants, your captains, and all that. All these people have to be leaders. Your unit supervisors and your division supervisors, all these people have to be, you know, leaders. So I just don't see us working together to solve a problem. And that's a function of leadership.
Yeah. I see now that there is certainly a tremendous disconnect, disrespect, and lack of trust.
Absolutely.
On both sides, between the police department.
Absolutely.
And the citizens.
Absolutely.
How do you regain that, especially in light of this gun trace task force and so many rogue cops? Commissioner, how, if you were in charge, I'm going to wave a wand and make you in charge for a year.
The same way, Coach, I would do it the same way I did it when I first came in, because we were in a similar situation. Not so much for all the corruption, but we were in a similar situation. When I first became police commissioner, our law enforcement partners didn't want to have anything to do with us, both federal, state, and local. They didn't want to have anything to do with us. Our citizens didn't want to have anything to do with us. Nothing. I personally had to go to 260 community organizations in this city, and I went to every last one of them with my hat in my hand and said, please forgive us. In our arrogance, we thought we knew how to police you, and we were wrong. Tell me what it is you want us to do as a police department. I went to 260 police organizations. I went to DEA, FBI, ATF, and I went to all of them. And the federal attorney's office said, man, I need your help. Please work with me. You know what they said to me, all the people? Say, Lenny, because it's you, we'll work with you. Go ahead, Coach.
Here is my question, and it's almost like a dilemma. On one hand, I've always said that Baltimore, like D.C., like Philadelphia, New York, has its own uniqueness. So when you're looking for a police commissioner, I would think you would look for someone who's from the community knows him or her, and they trust him or her. But the other side of that, as you know, in some cases, there's so much politics and so much filth and corruption that people are saying, well, we don't want to get an apple from this barrel because the apple may be good, but the barrel is rotten. I remember when I first met you, here's my first meeting encounter with Commissioner Leonard Hamm. I was at an event, it was a restaurant, and you're sitting down and you're eating, and we're introduced, and you say, oh, how you doing, Coach? And we automatically hit it off, talking ball and everything. And I looked around and I said, man, where's your security? He said, I don't need security. These are my people. I'm from Baltimore. And then you looked at me and said, Coach, plus I can fight. And you smiled. But talk about that thin line of choosing someone from the community, part of the community, versus bringing someone fresh who may not be tainted.
Well, here's the thing. And what I think is that people, especially the people of Baltimore, they really don't care, I think, if you're from the community or not. Preferably if you were a good dude from the community. What they're looking for is someone that they can read and someone who they think is honest. And they're not looking for a guy who's an actor. See, people from most of the guys from out of town came here, they were actors. And people automatically know that. They know that. Coach, I wasn't an actor. First of all, I was from here.
That's right.
But I wasn't an actor. I want to, you know, I sat on my front steps on Sunday reading a paper and drinking a coffee. And people would walk up to me and say, man, I want to get out the game. You know, I don't like being this way. And I say, okay, we'll work with you. You know, we'll work with you. I went to high school basketball games.
Yeah.
And they would say, hey, you commissioner, what are you doing here? And people say, because they like watching basketball. That's real stuff. What I used to do was when I was interviewing me, I always thought this interview is for the women in the beauty shops, the guys in the bar, the guys that they're the ones that I'm interviewing for, not these reporters and all that stuff. And what I found was people saw a genuineness in me that they gravitated to. Now, there were always haters and all this kind of stuff, too. You know,
sure,
you're going to have 50%
sure.
people there, but you're going to have haters, too.
Mm-hmm.
But see, people can discern that about you. You know, they can discern whether you're phony or not. That's what has to happen. You know, you can't keep giving press conferences, for example, and have them scripted. I never had a scripted press conference. Never. I prepared myself for what the issue was and what the issues were and all that, and I would have been out just talking.
Wow.
And I just talked. So that's the people want to see that you're genuine, man. They want to see you genuine. Now, I had another advantage. I have another advantage, and I have to tell you this.
Okay.
I have a wife who's better than me.
Ain't no question about that. She's better than all of us.
she's better than me. I mean, you know, Rose would just go and do her thing, and people would say, well, if he married her, he must be okay. You met her. You know what she's like.
Let's talk about some of the issues facing your beloved city of Baltimore. A lot of cities, but especially Baltimore. Let's talk about the dissent. Yeah, the consent decree. Good thing or bad thing?
I think it's a good thing. You know, basically for me, the dissent decree is putting us back on track. I always thought that Baltimore Police Department had a good set of rules, regulations, and all that stuff. And most of these things that they're talking about, we aren't doing as a police department. We already had that stuff set up. The fact of the matter is people ain't doing it no more. They simply aren't doing what they're paid to do. They simply aren't doing their job. Simply aren't being held accountable. So I'm all for us being held accountable. I'm all for us being transparent. But what I want to see happen is the community get more involved in all of this process. Because in the final analysis, like I told you, you know, Coach, at one point, the consent decree and all these people who are doing it, they're going to leave. They're going to leave. The police commissioner is going to leave. These police officers, you know, are going to get aged and old, and they're going to leave. Who's going to be left? It's going to be the community. Community is the constant. The community is the constant. And to me, that's who we have to build up. That's who we have to work toward. That's who we have to empower. They're the constant.
And do you think that, and again, when I hear people talk about some are saying that it's prohibiting police officers from doing their job. Others are saying, no, it's not. It's just making them do the job appropriately and correctly. But when I hear people on our morning show calling up and saying on certain corners, North and Penn, for example, there are open-air drug markets, how can this be allowed to continue? If it is in fact going on, how can it be allowed?
If it's allowed to be going on here again, remember when I talked about leadership? That's a leadership issue. That's a leadership issue. Now, Pennsylvania North Avenue, when I was a commanding officer of the Central District, that's the border of the Central and the Western. Me and the Western commander would get together, and we wouldn't allow this. We would figure it out with help of the community. Because a lot of those people who are at North and Pennsylvania are people who are sick, and they need treatment, and they need medical help and all this stuff. So here again, if you want to do community policing, you know, how do we make this particular corner, you know, and to enhance the community and help the community solve problems? Policing, you have to work with the community to kind of figure this out. And that's where you bring in your outside professionals, and that's where you bring in all of these different people who want to help. But that's how you solve that. Police are not going to do that alone, but you know that takes some work.
Yeah,
you know that,
yeah.
And that, you know.
Man, I've heard.
But
what I'm saying to you is,
based on my experience and what we did in the past, it's solvable if you want to solve it. You got to want to solve it. You got to want to do it.
Yeah, there's so many pros and cons on this consent decree in Baltimore. Now, I'm hearing a term, and it's a huge political football, defunding police departments across the country. Your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, let's say this. You're not going to eliminate the Baltimore Police Department. That's not going to happen. You can forget about that. We have in the past defunded, taken funds from the police department and put them in other areas to help us solve problems. I would think that that's what people have in mind when they talk about defunding the police department. You know, taking some funds away from the department, put them in other areas that will help us solve some problems, like trauma training, for example. You know, mental health people, for example. You can incorporate those kinds of services with the police in order to help the community solve some problems. We did it in the past. We did it before. It can be done again. This is nothing new.
Congress, Democrats, trying to pass a bill that would create many reforms, including banning the chokehold. In your opinion, Commissioner Leonard Hamm, is a chokehold allowed in Baltimore City? Is it something that's necessary? Talk to us about the chokehold.
Look. First of all, let me say this to you, that all policing, like all politics, is local. Each police agency has to decide for themselves, and each community has to decide for themselves what they want to happen. A chokehold, I don't see where a chokehold is necessary to control a person or to do what is needed to solve a problem. You know, because here's the thing about police officers, Coach, and I don't think a lot of people understand what police officers' job is. A police officer's job, in my opinion, is simply to help the community solve its problems. Now, we give that police officer a lot of tool in their tool belt, you know, to do that. We give you the power of arrest, you know, and detention and all that stuff. But your job is to help a community solve its problems. So you tell me, how's a chokehold is going to help solve an individual problem? Well, I guess it depends on the circumstances and all that stuff. But if, in fact, you decide that you're going to put a chokehold on somebody, you better damn sight be able, as a police officer, to defend that as a probable cause and write that off. You better be able to do it. Because, here, you know, when you talk about chokeholds and all this kind of stuff and all this kind of stuff, you know, I think about Freddie Gray. All right? my opinion, Freddie Gray should have never happened. Freddie Gray ran from that scene, and these police officers chased him. And my question is, for what? Let him run. You know him. He's up here every day. You'll get him tomorrow. You'll get him the next day. What's your for what? What are your reasons for doing that? Is that really solving a problem? We have to retrain police officers, coach, on the premises of solving a problem. And what's the best way to solve this problem? It's not arrest. It's not a chokehold necessarily. It's not always the best way to do it. The best way sometimes could be just let them go, let them run. You'll get them later on.
I've heard you say that, and it makes a lot of sense because you would tell the police officers, look, it's not personal. Okay, it's not against you, John Doe, but it's against maybe a defiance or disrespect, rightfully or wrongfully, for the system. And so if you don't take things personally, then you have that open mind to do as you just say, let him go, and to prevent. That's the key, is it not, to prevent a bad situation?
That's the key. The key is to solve a problem. How are we going to solve this problem? Are we going to solve it in such a way that we create a greater problem, like Freddie Gray?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, we look at it even further. And I hate to be a Monday morning quarterback, but if I'm a wagon man, why am I going to put him in my wagon? I used to drive a wagon in the Baltimore Police Department. If a guy was injured or bleeding or drunk, he wasn't going to get in my wagon. You're going to call an ambulance because I ain't taking him. And I'm not taking him because once he's in my wagon, now he's my responsibility. So you have all of these things, man.
How do you eliminate, or not eliminate, but maybe decrease this code of blue? In other words,
three
police
ways.
Officers.
Three ways, coach.
Okay, go ahead, please.
And I've always said it. Recruitment.
Okay.
Supervision and discipline. You have to recruit the right kind of people. So you say, well, Commissioner, how do you recruit the right kind of people? You recruit the people who you bring in your agency with a sense of service and not a sense of adventure. And there are questions that you can put to a recruit to make you understand what that kind of person is.
I understand what you're saying, but that's important. Expound on
exactly.
That just a little more to let our listeners know, because that's very important. Service versus adventure.
That's right. You know, so you have to find those kind of people who act, and it has nothing to do with color, has nothing to do with sex, has nothing to do with any of that. You sit down, and as a person going through an interview, first of all, they fill out, you know, an application, so.
Mm-hmm.
Then you sit down, and you have an interview with that person. And you read that person. As a veteran police officer, you read that person. And you ask them certain questions about their feelings on certain things, you know. And you can see it. One of the questions is, for example, what do you eventually want to be in this department? Well, I want to be a narcotics agent, and I want to do this, I want to do that. That's a bell going off in my mind that here's a guy who want to be here, you know, for adventure. You know, if I ask a person, what do you want to be in this department? And that person says to me, I don't know. I just want to be here. Coach, I'm more inclined to take that person and groom him to be what I want them to be. Because here's a person that we can groom in a spirit of service. So where do you find these people? I would say go on any HBCU campus, criminal justice majors, and you'll find a whole bunch of them, both male and female. So Now you got to supervise these people once you get them, you know, out of the academy or in the academy, whatever the case may be. And your supervision has to be the right kind of supervision that you want. You have to supervise these people to do what it is you need them to do in order to serve the community. Not this mess about forget everything you learn in the academy. This is the way we do it here. And then the third part of that is discipline. Discipline can be in two forms. You find a person who makes a mistake, you discipline them through training, further training. You find a person who makes a mistake and you punish them because, hey, they didn't have the training, they did this and they did that. I have those three things real tight together.
Now, I've always said, and you're the perfect person to respond to this, you're talking about recruitment. But I've always said that in Baltimore City, and you compare that and you would know this better than I, but do you believe that the qualifications, that bar should be raised a little higher so we can get more Leonard Hams? As you stated, you had a college degree. And I'm not saying that every recruit should have a college degree 4 years, but maybe at least 2 years of college or something where you can get a higher character individual.
I think that there's value in a college degree. I will simply tell you now, because of high school instruction today, I think it leaves a lot of young people lacking in necessary skills, academic reasoning skills and everything else. So I would want a little more seasoned person, maybe a person who has worked on another job, who's been, you know, in another industry for maybe 3 or 4 years. Maybe a person with some college, but, you know, you would have to bring something a little more than just what we're asking for. If we're just asking for a high school diploma, a high school education, and a driver's license, it's got to be more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has to be. We continue this special conversation with former police commissioner, Baltimore City, currently the director of public safety, professor at Coppin State University. He is Leonard Ham. And Commissioner Ham, in the last 5 years or so, or 10 years, the top stories in Baltimore from a law enforcement perspective, you mentioned one, Freddie Gray. The other one, you know, the investigation, I guess, is still ongoing. I haven't heard much about it. But as much as you can say on both sides, and no one knows, but Detective Souter, I mean, it's still a mystery, and I don't know if we will ever get any closure on that very tragic situation.
Coach, I don't have enough information on that. And it is tragic. I know that there were two on this special commission that they put together. There were two veteran homicide detectives from Baltimore City who were on that, and they looked at the evidence. Gary Childs and Marvin Sidnor, revered homicide detectives, and they came up with a conclusion. But it dumbfounds me, and I don't have an answer for that.
Sure. I mean,
all I can rely on is what Marvin and what Gary came up with, and I trust them. Marvin is retired now. He has nothing to lose for telling the truth. Gary is retired now. He has nothing to lose for telling the truth. So, you know, at this point, I would just have to say I don't know.
What would you do? what would you do with, and to me, this does not seem as complex as some of the city leaders have made it out to be, but what would you do, what would your suggestions be to deal with this squeegee boy situation? Because this is an eyesore, it's a menace, and you can get these people off the
street, provide alternative education. Coach, here's the thing. The squeegee boys problem is a perfect community policing problem. Remember what I told you?
Law-abiding
citizens working with the community, enhancing the quality of life, solving problems, arresting offenders, you know, and all that stuff. A perfect example of what we can do with this. If it were me, I would put some of my popping criminal justice majors, you know, graduate students on this to figure out what we can do. Look at the resources and figure out what we can do. This is, it's a perfect example. And if, in fact, we were able to come up with solutions for this, I mean, we could model this all around the world. But there's a way to address that.
Wow. You know, back in the day, and speak to this, back in the day there was a code, and even some of the underworld people had a line. And when one of their own or when someone in the underworld crossed the line, then a respected officer who knew the streets could go to an individual and say, hey, man, you know, we can't have this. This is bad for me, and it's definitely bad for you. So how can we come together and solve this thing? Speak on that.
Coach, every successful city in the history of the world has had the proper blending of government, crime, and business to keep everything running smoothly. All right? Happened in ancient Greece. It's happened now. You know, you have government, business, and law enforcement working together to keep everybody in line. Now, when one of those factions got out of line, then you have this disconnect like we have it now. It's always been there, always will be there. Always will be that. Back in the day, if in fact, for example, if somebody hurt a police officer, we would go to certain people and say, if you don't have him here in an hour, everything is going to be shut down. And guess what? That person was walking to a police district.
Mm-hmm.
The perfect alignment of all that. So what got that out of alignment?
Yeah.
In my opinion, it was crack cocaine. When you had all these individual people coming along who would just cook stuff in the kitchen and cook stuff in the stove, that way you didn't have the kingpins really controlling that stuff. You had a whole bunch of independent people. And that's where this criminal thing got out of line. Remember I told you the perfect coordination of all three? That
piece
is out of line. And we haven't gotten it back in line yet.
Wow. Boy, we've got about 10 more minutes left, and we've extended this because of this is so special, and this has been just an awesome visit in the Coach's Corner, as I knew it would be, with Commissioner Leonard Ham. One of the issues, and I think it's the main issue, and people will ask the question, where in the heck are these guns coming from? It seems like it's so easy to get a gun. Can we stop it? Can we get some of the guns off the street, Commissioner?
Yeah, you can get guns off the street, but there has to be a concentrated effort in order to do that. That has to be part of the strategy. You have to have, you know, if you're going to do that, you have to have, you know, your ATF working with you. Look, when I was police commissioner, one of the things I did was federalize my detectives. DEA, ATF, my guys were working with them. When you federalize, you know, local detectives, I mean, they can go anywhere. So you have a case here, you get a gun here in Baltimore, you trace that gun to Texas. They had the ability to go to Texas and do that. That's the kind of cooperation that we had then. We can get that kind of cooperation back. It's got to be everybody locked in on this stuff. You can't have people working in silos. Can't have working in silos. Man, when I was police commissioner, the country had 12 DEA squads for the whole country. 12. Eight of them worked in Baltimore. Eight of them worked with me. So you say, well, how come you had that many people working with? Was Baltimore that messed up? No, Baltimore wasn't that messed up. Baltimore was the one that cooperated with them and made their job easy, and they enjoyed working with us. Those are the relationships that have to be established. Remember, I talked to you about leadership and relationships?
That's right.
Got to reestablish those relationships in order to get this stuff done, because these guns are beyond our borders. They're beyond our borders. But, you know, there is a way to do it. There's a way to do it. We did it. When I was police commissioner, we did that stuff.
Final two questions. You talked earlier, and man, it was so profound when you mentioned, and I'm paraphrasing, that doing an interview of a potential recruit, you were looking for the service, not the adventure.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you, and I've always believed that everything starts at the top, be it a commissioner, a mayor, in sports, a coach, that the top person sets the tone of the locker room in sports and the locker room, so to speak, in a police department. But how do you, as a commissioner, have a trickle down to your force showing respect for all citizens and not profiling? Because right now in this country, it's obvious that there is a lack of respect for black men and black people, but black men in general are not giving the same courtesies as white men. How do we change that mindset?
Well, here's the thing, Coach, and, you know, I can't really give you a broad template about that. All I can tell you is that there are little things that the leader could do. And
okay.
this is not going to seem like it makes any sense, but it does make sense. When I was police commissioner, you know, police officers who worked for me were instructed by the previous police commissioner, don't get on the elevator with me. So I'm getting on the elevator, you know, coming to work, and the officers were there, and they said, oh, and they were, I said, where are you going? What the fuck are you backing off for? Well, you know, we can't get, I said, you've been bringing your ass on, you got to go to work. Bring your ass on here, you go to work. That little thing, email permeates behind the whole district that it's a new sheriff in town. A new sheriff in town. Little things like that. Little things like I would have police officers, I would pull them off the street, one from each district, in their radios and all the stuff working the street, and I'd bring them up to the police commissioner's boardroom. They'd never been there before, and they thought they were in trouble. And I talked to them. I said, forget about that sergeant who ain't no good. Forget about that lieutenant who ain't that good. You're here talking to me. This is what I want to know from you. I want to know how you're solving problems on your post, and I know you're solving these problems and ain't telling nobody, because when I was a police officer, I did the same thing. I want to know how you're solving these problems. So basically what you do is you let the troops see you as a human being, a real guy who's
mm-hmm.
concerned about them and concerned about their problems.
You know that.
Now, when you find a police officer who violate that, chop his balls off. Can I say that on the radio?
Hey, this is a podcast. You're
okay,
good.
All right. That's what you do. And guess what? That get around, too. That get around, too. Don't play with him. He ain't about that. But
man,
that's how you do it. You have to make yourself human to your troops, man. You got to make yourself human, which means you got to come down on their level and speak to them on their level. And they'll get the message.
Should we bring back the pound centers?
We got to bring back recreation, period. Because were it not for recreation, I would have never been police commissioner. Recreation is putting money on the front end, not on the back end. We got to do that. Now, here's the thing about the power centers. I don't want police to man, you know, to run power centers. I want people who are skilled, who have degrees in recreation, who know what the hell they're doing to run that stuff. Police don't have no degrees, and they don't know what the hell they're doing, you know. But we need to bring rec centers back.
And I mentioned the PAL centers because that's another way of connecting with the community. I know in some cases they have, what, touch football games on Thanksgiving. They used to do
They have a lot of things, you know, and we can partner with PAL centers, but understand what I'm saying. I don't want police to be running that stuff because for liability issues, you know, they don't know how to run no damn PAL centers. I mean, they didn't go to school for that. We need people who went to school for stuff like that. Police can come in and visit. Police can be partners. Police can be sponsors.
Mm-hmm.
But I want rec people like Cleve Brister, who knows what the heck he's doing, to run that stuff.
The best, yeah.
That's right.
The best, yeah. Absolutely.
To run that stuff. And like Cleve would say to me when he was running Shake and Bake up on Pennsylvania Avenue when I was commissioner of the Central District, he said, you know, Major, I need your help. I said, man, you ain't got to say it. And the troops were there.
Mm-hmm.
That's the cooperation that we need, and that's cooperation we need to get back to.
And finally, let's talk about this wonderful book, and I was just so honored and blessed to just contribute the Ham Rules. Now, we got the Jordan Rules, but now the Ham Rules. What are the Ham Rules?
Well, here's the thing, because let me tell you. I wrote this book because my son said to me, Pop, these guys want to know how you came from Cherry Hill to be a police commissioner. You got to write a book. And my wife encouraged me, got to write this stuff there. Got to write this stuff now. So I said, okay. So I started writing. I didn't have a title. So I read the book. I said, now what am I going to call this thing? And what I found out was the book was nothing about police. It was about how to make people successful and however they define success for them. So after I read the book, before giving it a title, I said, that's what the title should be. The Ham Rules for Relationships, Leaderships, Community, and Love. That's how I came about. And thank you for writing your testimonial for that, too. I really appreciate that.
Oh, man, I was honored. And you talk about thanks. Thank you for this wonderful, wonderful visit in the Coach's Corner, man. This is... You know, my producer, you know, he'll send me a text and say, man, this is great. And he'll say, this is the best one. And he just sent that text saying, think this is the best one. And I would agree. And, man, I know the lines were lit and people were listening in. I want to give a special shout out to the aforementioned, your wife, Rose, wonderful educator. I mean, she knows the educational process back and forth, like you know the policing, and then of course Cleve and Clayton and Coach Bob Wade and all the people out there listening. Yeah,
I call them. You know what I do with them? I call them the Godfather, Tessio and Clemenza. That's who they. That's who they are. Yeah,
no,
my God,
no question.
Man.
And I want to give a special birthday shout out to some of your friends, Miss Johnson Turner, celebrating a birthday.
Oh, yeah.
Wonderful educator in her own right.
Mm-hmm,
well, Commissioner,
mm-hmm.
You're familiar with the show. You know, before we end, I always ask my guests to leave our listeners with some parting shots. We call it WOW, Words of Wisdom. None better than Leonard Hamm.
I will say this, not only in my life, but in most people's lives, they've always had to make a decision, believe it or not, and I want everybody to think about this. You've always had to make a decision as to whether you want to be popular or successful. Understanding what popular is all about. I want to be a part of that crowd, what everybody's doing and all that kind of stuff. Or do you want to be successful? Successful means you're going to piss a whole bunch of people off. They're not going to like you. They're going to talk about you and all this stuff. But you will go ahead and you will go to the next level and you will succeed. I have always decided that I want to be successful as opposed to being popular. That's my parting shots, Coach.
And, man, my parting shot is, boy, you know what? I need to come and visit your closet, man. And just talk about this before you go. All right, and we've talked about everything. But tell us the origin of your passion for fashion. Because every single time, and a shout out to another one of your main men, great guy, Terry Warren. You guys are always clean, man.
For me, the thing about fashion and a lot of people, I understand fabric.
Yeah, you do.
I went to school for fabric. I made fabric. Fabric is the thing that makes fashion. So my fascination is with fabric. I deal with complete wool all the time, you know, on 150, 180. And when we take that wool can make any kind of fashion that you want. So that's what I do. I start with the fabric because I know fabric. And I have people that I work with who will then coordinate any kind of fashion that I want based on the fabric.
Well, you know, back in the old days, we used to call them vines. And every time I
right.
see you got a bad vine on. And some slick shoes, man. But look, I love you. I appreciate
Coach,
you.
I appreciate that, man. I appreciate that. Man. I really do.
Well,
and I appreciate your support over the years. You've always supported me. And I know that on your radio talk show, you know, in the morning with Larry, they talk about me badly sometimes. And you have always been there to defend me. And I appreciate that, brother.
And I will always be there because, you know what, there's a difference between an opinion and a fact. And you know what I tell them? I said,
mm-hmm.
I stopped worrying about what people's opinions were when I found out I couldn't pay my bills with them. Okay? and then finally, a lion never loses sleep over an opinion of a lamb. Okay? So
right. You're right.
Commissioner, this was special. Thank you so much for
Coach, thank you for
here
having me. I really appreciate
school.
It, brother.
My man. Thank you.
Take care.
All right, folks, hope you enjoyed it. I know I told you this would be special. And that's why the show is coined In and Out of Sports. And that's what we did tonight. We talked about sports, and we also talked about policing and community relationships. Well, stay tuned because Monday, we've got Charles Smith. You remember Charles Smith, Georgetown University, the Boston Celtics. We've got Charles Smith visiting in the Coach's Corner. I want to thank Horton's Funeral Services, 202-829-9000, simply the best for 80 years in the DMV for family funeral care. 202-829-9000 Randolph Horton, my brother, my friend. Dr. Edward T. Buford, premier dentist in the D.C. area, 202-667-8818, 202-667-8818. And, of course, I want to thank my super producer. He is Rick Hampton Sr. for making us sound good once again. And, folks, visit, write it down, theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com. It's theAfricanAmericanAthlete.com to get this interview tonight and the previous interviews on In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. Well, folks, hope you enjoyed the show tonight. We'll see you on Monday at 7 p.m. when Charles Smith of Georgetown and the Boston Celtics visit the Coach's Corner. But until then, make good decisions, because life is hard, but it's even harder when you're stupid.